This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Greg Pfeiffer was a self-described nerd, a Star Trek junkie who loved watching the space shuttle take off and dreamed of becoming an astronaut. So when a University of Wisconsin professor who'd walked on the moon told him how a spaceship cargo bay full of helium-3 could conceivably provide enough fusion fuel to power the entire United States for a year, Greg was hooked. Helium-3 didn't work out, but Greg and his professors came up with a new idea for a fusion company. Greg started Shine Technologies in 2010. It now has about 400 employees, has raised nearly $700 million, and has revenue-producing products on the market. Greg, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Hi, Kathleen. My pleasure to be here, and thank you for the kind intro.
Well, I think you deserved it. Let's start out talking about the difference between fission, which is how our current nuclear reactors work, and fusion.
Yeah, so the words, you know, kind of sum it up in that fission is sort of a word that means to split things apart. And in general, you're taking very heavy nuclei and splitting them into smaller ones. And that process releases energy. Fusion, as the word implies, is that you're actually, you know, putting two smaller nuclei together and fusing them. And that also releases energy. And so that's kind of, you know, two ways, I guess, of accessing what we would call nuclear energy, one fission, one fusion. The other big differences are that fission is actually fairly easy to make happen. It happens at essentially room temperature or even colder. Actually, the colder you are, actually, the better fission works. And fusion, on the other hand, you need to be at extremely high temperature to make work. So, you know, think 100 million degrees or more. So fusion is much harder. And so fission is much more accessible, but fusion actually is much cleaner, as we'll probably talk about going forward.
So banging things together is easier than pushing them apart, huh?
Yeah, it gets down into the nuclear physics and the fact that fission is caused by a particle called a neutron, and the neutron has no charge. It's a neutral particle, and so it can get close to the nucleus of a fissile material like uranium. And it can approach at very low speed. It never gets repelled essentially by the nucleus. So fission can happen at room temperature where those neutrons are moving very slowly. And actually, the more slowly the neutron moves, the higher the probability of it interacting with the nucleus. But in fusion, because you're slamming things together, and it's not a neutron, you're actually slamming together two positively charged nuclei. So these particles are each positive, and as they get close together, you might expect like charges repel. And so the two nuclei tend to push themselves apart. So if you don't bring them together at a very high speed, that repulsion never lets them get close enough for the nuclear reaction to happen. So that, I guess, is fundamentally why fusion happens at a much higher temperature, is you've got to overcome this, like charges repel phenomenon, whereas in fission, you don't have to do that.
You took a class at University of Wisconsin-Madison called Resources from Space. It covered everything from helium-3 to the origin of the solar system to how to get to Mars in a fusion-propelled rocket and scenarios for living and working on Mars. That inspired you to write your PhD dissertation about helium-3. Why didn't the helium-3 idea work for fusion?
Yeah, and it's not impossible that helium-3 can be made to work for fusion in particular, but the technology we had been working on didn't turn out to be an efficient way to fuse helium-3. So helium-3 is what we call an advanced fuel for fusion versus like what we would call first generation fuels of deuterium and tritium. So, you know, fusion, when we talk about 100 million degrees, deuterium and tritium is the easiest reaction to make happen. And that happens at about 100 million degrees in most systems. But helium-3 reactions happen at much higher than a billion degrees. And so, you know, you've got to get even hotter. The technology we had worked on was a potential way to get to those really, really high temperatures. But as it turns out, you know, there's a lot of complexity when you, again, nature being very, very clever at finding ways to cool things off. Fundamentally, our technology, something called inertial electrostatic confinement that we worked on in graduate school, just didn't pan out, at least not in the gridded systems we were using to be able to efficiently cause that reaction. We did cause enough of it to measure it, but certainly not enough of it to be useful.
So when you finished graduate school, you confronted the depressing idea that not only had helium-3 not worked, maybe there was no way to make any form of fusion commercially viable. What changed?
And to be clear, from the standpoint of producing electricity, and it turns out we're actually really good at producing electricity very inexpensively. And most people who pursue nuclear fusion are doing so with the end goal of making electricity. And so in order to bring fusion to the table, even if the technical problems could be solved to make it produce more energy than it consumes, and we haven't done that yet. So people haven't done that yet, except in, I guess, the hydrogen bomb. But we haven't done it in a controlled way where we're producing more energy than we consume. But even if you can overcome that, you still need to be able to produce energy at a rate that's a cost that's competitive to alternative production methods. And when you look at fusion reactors, these are some of the most complex technical environments, have to operate in one of the harshest set of conditions ever created by humans. So think this 100 million degree substance, and then you've got, you know, with at least deuterium and tritium fusion, the easiest reaction to do, a huge number of neutrons, and neutrons tend to damage materials over time. So you've got really expensive materials in proximity to really damaging conditions. And that results in essentially a very expensive machine that needs to have parts replaced pretty often. So when I was in grad school, I was in a fusion engineering program, actually. The point of the whole program was to find ways to make fusion commercially viable. And yeah, when I graduated, not everybody sees it this way, but when I graduated, I didn't see a path to making fusion cost competitive for electricity generation.
You've got to keep it contained as well, I assume, because it's so hot, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, generally, if you can't perfectly contain it or nearly perfectly contain it, the material, the fusion fuel just cools off, and you can't cause fusion to happen.
So you were telling me when we prepped for this, more than 300,000 years ago, humans learned to control fire, starting the era of chemical energy. One of the things that motivates you is the belief that we're now in a transition to fusion. Can you talk about that timeline and what that world might look like?
Yeah, so I do believe we are sort of in the transitional period. And when you think on those sort of timescales, this is like a single turn of a page in a book where, you know, the whole last chapter has been humans fueled by chemical energy, learning to control fire, you know, a long time ago. And we're at a point where we're going to change that. That to the next chapter, which will be humans fueled by nuclear energy. And while we've learned to control fission, and we already have some access to nuclear energy, fission is not, in my opinion, going to be the path forward for humans. I think that you have a lot more potential for unlimited energy from fusion. You have a lot more potential to make fusion reactors much smaller and much safer and much more cost-effective over time. In a high-tech world, fusion is the way humans will make energy. And when we can, we won't have to worry about energy for a long time again. I see fusion as the way humans will generate energy for the next million years. Now, that's looking out a ways. but I absolutely think that it'll trigger an era of energy abundance for us, where we won't have to worry about energy supply. We won't have to worry about greenhouse gases and essentially have an unlimited fuel source. So fusion is the way we're going to go. That said, it is at the cutting edge of technology today. And we're getting better and better, and we're moving faster and faster. And indeed, with a lot of the private investment you're seeing in fusion, in addition to a long history of public investment, you know, fusion's making progress. I think the time frame for commercialization of fusion as an electricity source is probably 20 years out. I hope we can go faster than that, but that's kind of the way I see it today. Beyond that, you know, I think it's probably going to be at least another 10 years after that's demonstrated before it's producing a meaningful amount of power on the grid. So, you know, we think long term when we think about fusion, but again, in the sort of historical context of, you know, the last few 100,000 years, we've been a chemical species, and, you know, the forward-looking million years, we're probably going to be a fusion society. You know, we've got a really exciting transition that we get to be a part of right now. So, yeah. That's very exciting.
can hear how pumped you are about it. We're going to take a short break and come back to talk more about with Greg Pfeiffer, a physicist working on fusion, and hear about his company. Back with Midwest Moxie. We're talking with physicist Greg Pfeiffer, founder and CEO of Shine Technologies, a Janesville, Wisconsin company whose fusion technologies provide neutrons for advanced industrial inspection, medical isotope production, and other applications. Greg, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the company you started to help create a fusion-fueled world. When you finished your undergraduate work at University of Wisconsin in 1999, you had a degree in physics and electrical and computer engineering. At that time, computer engineers were very much in demand and very well paid. Why did you choose to pursue your PhD in physics and earn a graduate stipend that was about 15% of what you could have made if you'd worked for a company?
Yeah, great question. I'm not sure most people would make that decision, but certainly some would. And, you know, as previously discussed, I took this class, Resources from Space, taught by two super inspirational people. One, Harrison Schmitt, you mentioned, who was the 12th astronaut, I guess, to walk on the moon. He was the geologist that trained all the other astronauts who walked on the moon what to look for. And then they decided to send him up on Apollo 17 and make sure they kind of got the expert to look at the moon rocks directly. And then another guy, Jerry Kolsinski, who was really my mentor at the University of Wisconsin, and he ran something called the Fusion Technology Institute. And in this class, we talked about nuclear fusion and its potential to move the world into this new chapter. And that was really, really exciting to me. So I just, you know, while interviewing, I thought I'd go talk to these guys because I remembered that class and it kind of stuck in my head. And, you know, they very quickly said, no, you don't want to go do that. You want to come work for us. And yeah, it's a lot less money, but, you know, you're going to help, you know, be able to help usher in this fusion age. And I was like, okay, that's really awesome.
So when you say do that, what would that have entailed?
Oh, it would have been as an engineer designing, you know, architectures for essentially graphics cards were probably the hottest business back then. Companies like NVIDIA that are now sort of at the forefront of parallel processing and even AI integration, you know, they had a major market, which was making video games run faster. And it turns out those same architectures that make video games run really fast allow us to do lots of parallel processing for like self-driving cars and things like that. But that was it back then, really valuable. These companies grew really fast. I mean, companies like NVIDIA today, we wouldn't have imagined it back then, are significantly more valuable than like Intel Corporation.
So get paid a lot to make video games go faster or get paid a little to think about fusion?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's right.
Okay. I guess we're learning a lot about you already. From the beginning, you've had a four-phase approach to Shine Technologies. You only talked about the first couple phases initially so that investors would, you know, not freak out. But your idea was that you could build one part of the business to generate revenue, then use that revenue to build out another part of a more difficult part of the business. So let's talk about each phase. You're well into phase one, right?
Yeah. And again, just to recap, the approach is not any different than what we've seen like in semiconductors or other industries where you've just made huge progress, right? Steve Jobs dreamed of having a computer in everyone's household, but at the time they were building sized. And so what they did was create a product that not everybody could use, but there were some people who could use and they would pay a lot for it. In doing so, made a more efficient, smaller product that more people could use, and thus you grew your market and you were able to drive down cost. And now we've all got computers in our pockets, right? So we're kind of following that sort of model, which is get to market, build a product, use that knowledge and experience to build it more efficiently, drive costs down and increase access to new markets. So that's kind of how we thought about it. Phase one for us was, you know, and we talked a lot about fusion producing energy, but it also produces these particles that have value. And the particles that have value are called neutrons. And it turns out, like, on a per nuclear reaction basis, the neutron can be far more valuable than the energy produced from fusion. So that was the thesis of the company, was we can use this neutron to capture value. And so phase one of the business, we essentially looked for the most, what area could we get paid the most per reaction? And it turns out that using fusion to produce these neutrons can be applied to an industry called neutron radiography. And in neutron radiography, you use neutrons to take pictures of the inside of things. As the world makes more and more mission critical components out of light materials like carbon fiber, like plastic, neutrons are increasingly valuable. So there was a niche market where there are absolutely critical products like the turbine blades on engines for jets, right, that have to have neutron inspection to make sure the engine doesn't explode. And there was only one place in the world, or one set of places in the world that could do this, and that was very specialized nuclear reactors. We developed technology, from fusion and then some spin-out technologies that are a result of our work in fusion that allowed us to produce neutrons without a nuclear reactor and therefore, drive the cost down, but get paid.
So phase one, you've got customers, you've got revenue. And phase two, let's talk about that. That involves medical isotopes, radioactive medical isotopes.
Yeah. And so when we were kind of commercializing, I knew right when starting my first company that we could commercialize phase one. I knew the technology had the potential to do that without any further improvement. But while commercializing that, I wanted to see what a path to the, to the future of fusion energy might look like. And so what I wanted to do is take reasonably small steps, in my opinion, which are actually kind of big steps, but reasonably small steps technologically, where you'd be able to see your way from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. And at that time, also looked at were there actually unmet social needs and market needs for technology at that point? And so we kind of mapped that out actually very early. And so phase two essentially said, if we could reduce the cost of a fusion reaction by about 1,000 times, so it sounds like a lot, right?
Yeah.
We would now be able to produce enough neutrons at a low enough cost to actually be able to do transmutation. So instead of just taking pictures, we can use the neutrons to change one element into another. You can think of it as alchemy, but it actually works. Nuclear engineers call it transmutation. And in particular, we're trying to turn low-value materials into what I'll call hyper-valuable materials. So it turns out the most interesting markets and largest markets for these hyper-valuable materials are medical isotopes. So one example, we can use the neutrons we produce from fusion to cause fission reactions in uranium. We can buy uranium for like $6 a gram, and it turns into something called molybdenum-99 when we irradiate it, which we can sell for about $150 million a gram.
Wow.
If you think about that, yeah, right. Like one of those little sugar packets that you might dump in your coffee is usually about 2 grams. So that's like $300 million worth of molybdenum-99. Another product in phase two that we are already producing today, something called lutetium-177, which is used for cancer therapy. And that's worth about $1 billion a gram. So, we're using neutrons at this stage now to transmute low-value materials into these very, very important materials for diagnosing disease, for treating disease. And we've got two facilities under construction that when complete, as I mentioned, we've got pilot scale production already going on lutetium, but these two facilities when complete will be the largest isotope production facilities in the world for both molybdenum-99 and lutetium-177, and both ultimately powered by fusion reactions.
Right here in the Midwest, in Wisconsin,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Gainesville, in the middle of a cornfield, as you know.
phase three, you're just getting going on, and that's where you're going to use your fusion know-how to recycle waste from our current nuclear fission power plants, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is obviously an important unmet need in that we've got all this waste that has been built up over the last 50 years of fission plant operation, and it's kind of a legacy we're leaving, to future generations. But probably even more important than that, nuclear waste not having a closed fuel cycle, in other words, not having an answer of what to do with the waste, is a big impediment for nuclear fission power becoming a bigger part of the energy mix today. And it's important that it does, because fission is one of the most reliable, most stable sources of carbon-free electricity generation that we have. So if we're serious about climate change, in other words, if we really believe it, which I do, and I think many do, you have to embrace fission, but you'd really want to have a solution to the waste in doing that. So, you know, that's what we plan to do. The technology we've developed for the medical isotope production facility in many ways has caused us to practice the skills we need to recycle nuclear waste. And it turns out, actually, that what's called nuclear waste has the vast majority of its energy content still available. And with just a little bit of recycling technology, you can turn it back into fuel and put it back in the reactor. So what better disposal plan, I guess, than saying, well, we're not even taking fresh uranium, we're just burning our old waste over and over and over again. So yeah, we've developed technology that should allow us to cost effectively provide that service to humans to allow nuclear fission to be a better part of the energy mix and help solve climate change.
I keep saying, wow, I sound like a broken record. And then phase four is generating electricity from fusion, which we've kind of talked about. I want to move to another topic. It took you 4 years to convince your first institutional investor to make an investment. Tell us about that. This seems like, wow, a lot you're trying to do. Why would someone put money in?
Yeah, and let me just give it this opportunity to give a shout out to the angel investors of Wisconsin who kept us alive for all that time. One of the most exciting things to me about Shine is we had such strong support from Wisconsin for so long is that a lot of our returns will frankly come back to Wisconsin. And so that's something very proud of and very excited and looking forward to doing for all of our early supporters. But yeah, for institutional investors, this was a tough story for them to understand because you don't have many of them who understand the risks associated with nuclear regulatory permitting. And then you, on top of this, you've got this oligopolistic healthcare market, medical isotopes. And it's pretty difficult for people to understand. So, you know, we would go in and we would pitch and we would say, here's why we're going to win. You know, this replaces aging nuclear reactors. There's a big tailwind for share acquisition. We can do it cheaper. We're safer. We're cleaner. And they were just like, okay, sure you are. And so our first institutional investor is a private equity fund called Deerfield Management Company out of New York. Really good guys, but they told us no a lot of times, certainly more than even four times during that time period when we'd ask them to invest. And, you know, I think in our first meeting, one of their team members, a guy named David Clark, said, I wrote a list down of all the things you said you were going to do. And when you left the room, we looked at each other and we're like, he's not going to get any of these things done. And by the time we invested, you did them all. And so, you know, it was just a matter of, frankly, building credibility with, look, a group of people who are skeptical investors. That's their job. But they wanted to invest. They always loved the narrative. They needed to see us prove some things first. So we were just tenacious and just got after it.
After more than a decade of slugging away at this, suddenly in the last year or two, there's been a lot of money going into other fusion companies. Is that good or bad for Shine?
It's great for everybody, I think. From Shine's perspective, we like to see a lot of technology investment in fusion in general, because I think the technology to actually make fusion work is still early stages. And it's good to see all these different concepts being pursued and invested in. For us, you know, we've got our own ideas on fusion and our own paths to commercializing it with our own technologies. But this is such a big market at the end of the day. We could easily see ourselves partnering with other companies that develop technology should they be successful. And, you know, one of the things we're building that I don't see anywhere else is this really strong execution competency. So we're not only a technology company, we certainly are that, but we've got the ability to get the regulatory permits and experience in dealing with the NRC. We've got the ability to build complex projects. In fact, we've done one of them through a pandemic and the biggest supply chain disruptions you can imagine. And so that project delivery team that we're building, that experience in delivering real systems in the real world at cost-effective prices, you know, that's something I think that we're going to have that nobody else is going to have. So maybe there's a model where somebody else makes technology work and we license it or we help them build it because we're really good at that. So most important thing for us is to help be part of the fusion solution. We don't need to be everything, although we're, like I said, we certainly have our own ideas and technology as well.
Well, and you're the technology guy, obviously, the physicist and everything else. You didn't think you'd be CEO for very long, but you keep being CEO. How come?
Yeah, so, you know, it's sort of what the company needs. So at the end of the day, we want to get it over the line. I definitely, when I started Shine, did not think I'd be the CEO for a very long time. But, you know, when we looked at, frankly, the ongoing needs for the leader of this company, you know, to understand the risks of where you're going in this really high tech space and some of the solutions. And then just to like be able to grow with the company and scale the people with the company. We benefit from a really deep team of broad experience at Shine, but sort of that technical visionary is what the company needs. And I think as we continue to grow, that's going to continue to be the case, at least for a while now.
Yeah, I think about the layers of technology knowledge that you must have to do this. What advice do you have for highly technical people who want to do this really hard job of starting deep tech companies?
Yeah. And so you got to ask yourself if you're in a good place in your life for it, because it's probably it's going to take time. I mean, deep tech versus like software, it takes a ton of time and investment, and you have to convince people that you're worth it, frankly. And then the other thing is there's going to be these ups and downs. And in the deep pits, you know, you got to ask yourself, does the thesis still hold? And it's pretty easy to do that, actually. Like if you just kind of take the emotion out of it for a bit, and just be really analytical. And most people that are technologists can say, does the business case still work? You know, I've got thrown a setback. This isn't going to be as easy to do as I want it to do. But, you know, the market opportunity for us just kept getting stronger. The old reactors just keep getting older. The shortages just keep getting worse. There's no supply of significance in the Western Hemisphere now. So that story got stronger and stronger, even though the technology was more expensive to commercialize than we first thought. So just kind of go back and ground yourself in where you started, where you are. Does it make sense to keep going forward? And if so, don't worry about it. Like, just keep plugging forward. It's a risk compensated game. You're going to have to find a way to manage the stress. You know, when I didn't know how to manage stress well, I suffered from anxiety and panic attacks and, you know, the kind where you couldn't even stand up anymore. So, you know, you've got to be able to manage that. And I suggest exercise. I suggest, you know, conversations with psychologists if necessary. Understand that if you're going to do hard stuff, it's going to be hard, but it's also important. And so I think if you keep yourself grounded in that and the fundamentals of the business, that'll help drive you forward.
It's been so inspirational hearing your story and hearing about your motivation to make our world a better place. So thank you so much for sharing it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for the opportunity to be on, Kathleen.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Audrey Nowakowski. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.